I hope that applause was for Daniel, because he deserved it after that introduction. Thank you very much, Daniel, and thank you all for coming along this afternoon. It's a real pleasure to be here. I live just up the road in Waterloo, but I haven't spent nearly enough time in Toronto. As Daniel said, just give me a moment here. I've changed my sort of creative direction over the last couple of years or so, and I want to talk, I think something very big and very interesting is happening online, both sort of generally as it relates to human culture, and also specifically as it relates to science, and I want to share a few thoughts about this with you today. So let me start with something very concrete, or some concrete questions. How many people know what a blog is here? Okay, all right, no surprise. And I don't believe those of you who didn't raise your hands. How many people read blogs? Maybe once every couple of weeks, something like that. Okay, so about half of you, almost half of you. How many people actually run a blog or have contributed to one? Okay, so a few of you. And how many of you read blogs but won't admit it in polite company? No? Okay. All right. So either this is polite company or else, yeah, okay. All right. So I want to show you an example of a blog. It's a blog called What's New. It's run by this guy. His name is Terry Tao. He's a mathematician at UCLA. He won the Fields Medal, the highest prize in mathematics, in 2006. He's probably best known for the proof of what's called the Green Tao theorem. And if you follow sort of science generally at all, you may have heard about this. It's one of many, many big results that he's proved, but it's probably the best known thing he's done. So he proved that there exist arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions of primes using some very clever combinations of ideas. He's a very prolific blogger, so he wrote 118 separate blog posts in 2008. He's not sharing cat photos with his mathematician friends, at least not mostly, anyway. He's doing something a little bit more interesting than that. And I'll just give you one particular example. I want to start with something very concrete. So I want to talk about a particular post he wrote. There are many that are kind of similar. It's titled, Why Global Regularity for Navier-Stokes is Hard. And as you might guess, it's, of course, about the Navier-Stokes equations, you know, the equations we use to describe the liquid state of matter. And these are famously complicated partial differential equations, very, very difficult to understand, of course, connected to problems like turbulence and whatnot. So people like Feynman, Landau, and Kolmogorov each spent many years of their life trying to make some sort of progress in understanding it. And they made some progress, but really had relatively limited success in understanding those equations. One of the Clay Millennium Prize problems, very famous amongst mathematicians, the million-dollar problems, is to understand, basically what it is to prove the global existence of smooth solutions to the Navier-Stokes equations, given reasonable physical initial conditions. You don't allow completely arbitrary initial conditions. That's a rough kind of paraphrasing of the problem. So he wrote this post, just to come back, about that particular problem. Now, this is not meant to be a talk about the Navier-Stokes equations. There's a lot. I could easily give an hour. In fact, I could probably give a seminar course based on this post. There's an awful lot of content. What I want to do is I want to just give you a little bit of the flavor of what actually goes on in the discussion. So he starts out with a brief explanation of what the problem is. He drops a very interesting tidbit that I actually didn't know right in the sort of the first couple of sentences. He says that in two dimensions, the solution to this problem is actually known. It is possible to prove the global existence. And that's kind of, I mean, two spatial dimensions. That's kind of a remark. I mean, it's an incredible fact. And, you know, the obvious question is, why is it so much harder to do in three dimensions? And he says, well, the physicists have a standard answer, which is to invoke turbulence. But he doesn't really like that way of thinking. He prefers to think in terms of something that he calls supercriticality, which I'd never heard of before reading this post. And he explains it. I don't want to go into too much detail, but the basic idea is to try and find physical invariants, so quantities like energy or, well, actually more local, well, other quantities, which can be used to control the behavior of the solutions at all length scales, so both at large length scales and very small length scales. And basically what he says is that, unfortunately, the known invariants give you good control at large length scales in terms of the variation in the solutions, but only give you very weak control at shorter length scales. And furthermore, he says, look, you know, as a mathematician, as an expert in solving partial differential equations, he says there are really only three broad strategies of attack on proving existence results for nonlinear PDEs. One of these is to explicitly find a full solution, and he says, well, okay, maybe that'll happen, but it doesn't seem very likely. And he says, for the other two solutions, the other two broad approaches, supercriticality is a severe problem, and he explains exactly why that is. I should say, by the way, that, of course, the point about supercriticality is the fact that you have this control at long length scales is why the solutions tend to be fairly regular at long length scales. But you don't have any control over the solutions at small length scales, and somehow this is associated with the turbulent structure you see at very short length scales. That's kind of the intuition. Okay, so that's sort of the first two or three paragraphs of this 50-paragraph post. So I'm going to speed things up a little bit. He surveys the known invariants. He surveys and critiques all of the known attempts on the problem, broadly speaking. He says what goes on and what goes wrong. And then he describes six separate ways that he would consider attacking the problem. And he does a little survey of each of those and talks about the flaws and whatnot. So the post is absolutely full to the brim with all sorts of clever perspectives, insightful observations, and ideas. Basically, it's like having a chat with an extremely good mathematician who's willing to share all of their best thinking with you. It received 89 comments, and there were a lot from very well-known mathematicians. It just so happens, in fact, that there are two from the quantum information field, Greg Cooperberg and Gil Kalai, who are well-known, they're well-known mathematicians. But there were many other well-known mathematicians there. And basically, I mean, all they're doing is they're just batting ideas backwards and forwards, sharing their perspectives. These are not necessarily people who are experts on that, but they had some very interesting things to say. Furthermore, it started a discussion on other blogs, so other people started to talk about the same problem and sort of built on those insights. So that's just one blog post. Remember, I said he had 118 last year. Well, he had other posts about structure and randomness in the prime numbers. This is what he's famous for working on, amplification, some clever linear algebra tricks, a very deep result in mathematics, the Gromov's theorem. He explains a proof of that. He talks about, you know, what exactly is a gauge. So that's one guy, okay? Well, there are many other mathematics blogs. Here's Tim Gowers. He's another Fields medalist from Cambridge. He runs a blog, and he has all kinds of interesting discussions there about how to use Zorn's lemma, dimension argument. I really like this post. It's a discussion of the question, what exactly is deep mathematics? And then there's this guy, Alain Kahn, another Fields medalist at the IHS. And he also runs blog. He doesn't post quite as often as these guys, but he does post reasonably frequently. I really like this post. So Kahn, you know, he's the inventor of this idea known as non-commutative geometry. Which has been developed by many people over many years. One of the crazy ideas he has is that he wants to use non-commutative geometry to attack the problem of proving the Riemann hypothesis. And what he does here is he explains the motivation. It's okay. He explains the motivation. Basically, he says, look, I have a bunch of informal reasons why I think this is a good idea, which I can't really publish. They're not exactly, you know, publishable ideas, but here's the reason why I think this might be a good thing to do. So it's really nice. And another Fields medalist, Richard Borchards from Berkeley, also runs a blog, but like many bloggers, he gave up. You know, he couldn't keep up the pace. So this is actually the last post, almost exactly a year ago. It was Australia Day last year. So it's kind of a curious fact. 4 of the 42 living Fields medalists have blogs. Roughly 10%, 1 in 10 of them. And actually, if you think about the age distribution and you restrict yourself to some of the younger Fields medalists, of course, the fraction becomes much larger. I'm just talking in terms of sort of emerging trends in mathematics. There are many other very good mathematicians who also run blogs of various kinds. So, you know, this is a physics colloquium. Why am I talking about mathematics? I'm a physicist. Why am I talking about mathematics? I think it's just because for these particular examples, the trend is furthest advanced, or that something very interesting is going on in mathematics. I don't want to... I'm going to move away a little bit from blogging, but I will make some final remarks on it. So what exactly, you know, can we see from this? Well, first of all, blogging is very informal. It's very rapid fire. And critically, a lot of these ideas couldn't be published in a conventional way, at least not without a lot of reworking, and in particular, you couldn't have these kinds of conversations. So, you know, they're full of small, striking insights and general thoughts on sort of approaches to problems, which in some sense are too small to be published, but they contain the seeds of later progress. Certainly, particularly those of you who do theoretical work will recognise that, but it's also true for experimentalists. So in some sense, what's going on, it's a lot like scientific conversation in the conventional way we think about it, but it's a scaling up of scientific conversation. So it's very widely distributed, both in space, but also in time. And this is a really, well, both these points are very important. So the spatial aspect, you know, instead of having Terry Tower just giving a, you know, talking in the hall or in a lecture room or whatever, basically he can communicate with all these people through the rest of the world. And, you know, the best of those people can contribute their best insights back. This point about distributing the conversation in time, though, is a really interesting one. What it does is it makes scientific conversations searchable. So I would love to be able to do a Google search of all of my past conversations. I'm sure many of you know that. Actually, Danny Roderick, who's a economist at Harvard who runs a blog, he said that the biggest benefits of running the blog for him was the fact that he can Google his own thoughts. He said he Googles his own blog like remarkably frequently for exactly that reason. It's strange. I Google mine, actually, I should say. So if you do actually a Google search for Navier-Stokes problem, an interesting thing happens. The third result is actually Terry Tower's blog post. So in some sense, this is making it easy for future mathematicians to access that conversation. Now, you might say skeptically, well, shouldn't the best papers on the Navier-Stokes problem be at the top of the Google rankings? And actually, that's an extremely pertinent point. And really, if Google is doing, or whatever search company is doing its job properly, then the rankings should reflect the significance of the contribution, regardless of what it is. Whether it's a paper, it might be a recorded lecture. So many people are recording lectures and putting them online. It might be a blog post, whatever. To the extent they're doing their job right, that's what should be happening. And if you sort of think of it in those terms, then actually having it as the third returned ranking is not so bad for many people. You all know, of course, that having a good conversation with an insightful colleague is often worth more than reading the classic papers. Now, with that said, that's not true for everybody, right? It depends on exactly what level you're currently at. If you're a 17-year-old who's, you know, seen something on TV about the Navier-Stokes equations, Terry Tower's blog post is too hard. You'd be much better off being shown something else. If you're an expert who's been working on the problem for 15 years, it's also the wrong thing because you already know everything in there. Or actually, that's not quite true in that particular case. But, I mean, you know, there are some very striking ideas in there. But the key point, really, is that at the moment, search engines are not... There's some personalization, but it's actually rather a hack. But as certainly the search companies are very interested in moving to a much more personalised world, and the search results, ideally, in a search utopia, will gradually better reflect your interests and your needs. So the person who needs that post will see it, and the person who needs something more technical, one of the classic papers, will see that. Okay, so that's all I want to say about blogs. I want to talk a little bit about some people who are pushing the idea much further, people who are pioneering an idea they call an open notebook science. So what these people are trying to do is to systematically put all of their ideas online. They're trying to systematically put all of their data online, and also to provide ways of filtering it so you can get access to just the most pertinent information, right? You don't necessarily want a data dump of everything. Certainly not if it's all the LHC data. It's going to be too much. So let me show you some examples quickly of this kind of approach. Garrett Leasy is a theoretical physicist. basically a particle physicist, and he runs a wiki called Differential Geometry, and he simply puts everything that he does on there. So a lot of it is just basic kind of learning. I've shown here, he's just writing some basic stuff about the Lie group E8, and it's just his notes on it, so it's taken out of a textbook. But he also, he puts his thinking related to research on it. And you can go through, and pretty much in real time, you can track exactly what Garrett Lisi is thinking. He sometimes refers to it as his brain online. So this chemist at Drexel University, Jean-Claude Bradley, and he has a very sophisticated system set up. He has all kinds, basically his lab is wired in all kinds of interesting ways to different online tools. This is kind of Bradley central, but there are lots of other things that he links to, and they do all of their experiments through there, all completely in the open. Cameron Nalon is another chemist who does something very similar. He's at the University of Southampton. They've been exploring all sorts of interesting ideas. One I like is the fact that they've been modifying their lab equipment so it automatically posts to the web in real time. They do all kinds of automated logging. They do it in machine-readable formats in many ways. And so basically the hope there is that eventually they'll be able to do all sorts of data mining and automated inference where you can start spidering the output from many different labs. And there are people working on applications like this. So sort of the underlying attitude here is one of what I like to call extreme openness. And basically the idea is that, you know, scientists should take all the information in their heads and in their labs and put it out somewhere on the network. And that doesn't just mean papers, it also means data, it means their opinions, it means questions, ideas, all the little folk knowledge. Sort of the idea being that information not on the network can't do any good for other people. It's really the ultimate expression of the idea that the best person to build on scientific work may not be the original discoverer of that work. Okay, so that's sort of the concept of extreme openness. Let me show you one other illustration of this idea. It's something called Galaxy Zoo. So what is Galaxy Zoo? Basically, Galaxy Zoo, it takes data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and it makes it publicly available. Remarkable fact, something I didn't realize, is that apparently computers are still not very good at classifying what a galaxy is. So if you show it an image of a far distant galaxy, apparently it's quite difficult to tell whether it's an elliptical galaxy or a spiral galaxy in general. And so the idea was basically put all of these galaxy images up online, then train volunteers and see whether or not they can't do the classification. So they did this. You can go through the training program. It's remarkable, actually. So I did the training. It is really strange. What starts to happen, they show you all these images, and at first it's really easy, like, you know, that's a spiral, right? It's not exactly difficult to tell. But they show you gradually more and more complicated images, and eventually you're looking at things, and they just look like little blobs. They're basically indistinct blobs. But your intuition is really good. I don't know what's going on, but, you know, you sort of say, well, spiral, and you're right. More often than not. So they've had 80,000 volunteers. They've classified so far more than 10 million galaxies. But it's not a full classification. A lot of these images are very indistinct. So their goal is redundant classification. They want to have at least 20 people independently classifying each galaxy. I should say, by the way, they do all kinds of corrections. So the simplest thing they do, they're worried about biases, people's biases associated with their visual systems, so they do things like they mirror the images to make sure that, you know, there's no kind of bias being introduced somehow there, and I think there are some other things they do. So a famous little outcome of this. There are all kinds of reasons one might want to do this, but there's actually been some interesting kind of spin-offs, and one that received a fair bit of press, many of you probably heard it, earlier this year, was very early, about a month after Galaxy Zoo started running in 2007, a school teacher named Hanny Van Arkel, basically she'd gone through the training program, she'd started classifying galaxies, and she saw a funny image. This is very much blown up from what it was and recolored, actually. But she saw this blob, and she didn't know what it was, and so she posted to the Galaxy Zoo forum, and she said, "What is this?" And actually, nobody else knew what it was either. And after quite some considerable, there are papers being written about what exactly this might be now, and it's been named in her honour, Hannes Voorwerp. So she's Dutch. Apparently, Voorwerp is the Dutch word for object. So this is another example of this kind of extreme openness, where you can take privately held data and make it publicly available and extract some scientific value from it. Okay, so I want to change gears a little bit here. So I want to think about what exactly is going on. What's sort of the bigger picture? So blogs, open notebooks, and all these other kinds of things, open data applications, enable filtered access to new information sources and new conversations. That's what I've already said. There's another way of thinking about it. In some sense, whenever you have any form of new communications media, new way for people to conduct conversations, new ways for people to direct their attention, to filter their attention through search engines and other objects like this, and recommendation engines, what you're really doing is, in fact, you're restructuring expert attention. You're changing what people pay attention to. And we think about money and lab equipment and whatnot as being the limiting factors. But really, in some sense, expert attention is the ultimate scarce resource in science. If you can find the right person to solve your problem, well, that's the most powerful thing you can have. And the more efficiently it can be allocated, the faster science will progress. So I guess I was a theorist. My biggest frustration in research, it wasn't that I couldn't solve the big problems. It was all the little tiny problems that just kept coming up over and over and over again. And what's frustrating about those tiny problems is not that it would take you 2 days to solve them. It's that if you could locate the right person, it would take them 10 minutes to solve them. Because almost everything that you're doing, you're not actually particularly expert in. Right, so in the economist's language, what you really want to do is to locate a person who has great comparative advantage in solving your particular little micro problem and get them to do it. But in practice, that's very difficult to do. Of course, the economists have developed a very good way of allocating scarce resources, which we're all familiar with, the miracle of the market. This idea, don't laugh. I know a lot of people are down on markets at the moment. Actually, there's a great story from Paul Seabright, who's an economist. He was working in London, I think for the World Bank. This was 1991, and somebody from the former Soviet Union came. This person had been responsible. He was one of the central planners of the economy in the Soviet Union. Anyway, so lots of backwards and forwards. He'd come to help in setting up the market system in the Soviet Union. And Seabright says that they were not connecting at all. Couldn't see. And finally, this guy, he just burst out with, but who's in charge of the bread supply to London? And the answer, nobody is astonishing. Right? It's really astonishing. The market is, in some sense. That's how we allocate those scarce resources. And it works much better than having a very smart, very committed person do it. Or even a very committed team of people do it. Okay, so there are, in fact, now some online markets in expert attention. How many people have contributed to an open source project? Okay, so a few of you. That's a kind of a market in expert attention. I want to show you one that's much more ambitious. It's a market that's called Innocentive. It's an online market. I'm going to actually go around the world, to the other side of the world, to India. Before I come back to Innocentive and the online market and expert attention, I want to talk about a not-for-profit organization called the ASSET India Foundation. And basically what ASSET does is it exists to help some of the 2 million women involved in prostitution in India, basically to help some of the at-risk girls escape, mostly daughters of sex workers. And the way they do that is they provide them with education. They provide them with training in technology. And they've set up actually quite a few training centres now through India. And according to the executive director of ASSET, they receive, he said, on the order of 10 requests a month to set up centres in smaller towns. Unfortunately, many of the towns that request such centres don't have access to good electricity. And if you're trying to set up a technological training centre, that's obviously a pretty significant problem. So one of the things that they want is they want to have wireless routers. In those training centres, and they decided that what they needed was a low-cost solar-powered wireless router. And they looked around, And actually, they weren't able to find one that was suitable for their needs. There are people working on things like this, but for whatever reason, they weren't able to get one. So now Innocentive comes back into the story. Innocentive is on the other side of the world. It's in Waltham, just outside Boston, Massachusetts. And it's an online market in expert attention. So it basically, big companies like Eli Lilly, Procter & Gamble, there's about 70 companies involved, can pose at the Innocentive website online challenges, and these are just scientific research problems together with prizes for solutions. So the kind of thing that comes up in-house, and they want prizes. So here's an example. It's actually a little atypical. It just happened to be the first one that came up when I took this screenshot. What it is, it's a challenge to find a biomarker for measuring the disease progression of motor neuron disease. And the sense in which it's atypical is that the prize is actually $1 million. Most of the prizes are more like a few tens of thousands of dollars is perhaps typical. So something like 160,000 people have registered for the site from 175 countries. More significantly, more than 200 of the challenges have now been solved. So what's this got to do with ASSET India? Well, remember, you know, ASSET had this problem that they wanted solved. So they got in touch, in fact, with the Rockefeller Foundation and said, look, we want this low-cost solar-powered wireless router. Rockefeller said, you know, that's great. We think you're doing very good work. We'll put you in touch with Innocentive, and furthermore, we'll put up a $20,000 prize for a design for such a wireless router. Okay, so it goes onto the website. Innocentive broadcasts it out to all the people in the world. 400 people downloaded the challenge. I should say, when I say 400, you know, it's not difficult to download a challenge, but you do have to, you know, it's not completely trivial either. That indicates some level of commitment. You know, you've already read an abstract of it and whatnot. More significantly, 27 of those people submitted solutions. Okay, and there was one from this guy, Zachary Brown. He's a 31-year-old software engineer from Texas. Now, get this. His hobbies are fooling around with wireless devices and solar power. Yeah. He's the right guy. Right? So he walks away with 20,000. ASSET walks away with the design for low-cost solar-powered wireless router, and they got the intellectual property for it. And furthermore, actually, there's a nice sequel to this. It's now being prototyped at the University of Arizona. Some engineering students are actually building a prototype. So, you know, it's not yet actually in production use, but who knows? Maybe it will be. Okay, so I've talked about some sort of positives or some interesting examples, I think, of nascent things that are going on online, this restructuring of expert attention. Now, a reasonable question to ask yourself is, well, you know, aren't all these new forms of contribution just a distraction? You know, should you blog if you're a graduate student when instead you could be writing papers? Right? Or if you're an assistant professor, should you be contributing to Wikipedia when you could be writing grants? More generally, why should you share your ideas, your data, whatnot online, when other people might build on those ideas without giving you full credit? You know, they can potentially write papers or whatever. And in the short term, these are all important questions. And I guess I could give easily another talk about exactly those questions. But sort of sorry, I've lost the track of my thought a little. I'll give you a very short answer. It's maybe not complete. It's not compelling. What I think I want to say is, you know, these are very important questions in the short term. They're critical questions. You know, it's fine for Terry Tao to be doing this, but should everybody else be doing it? You know, there are serious career impacts potentially, or things that you actually, you know, you need to be concerned about before getting involved in these kinds of things. It's a complicated question, and it's one that really needs an extended answer. So I'm going to give you a very short answer, which is not at all, it's not adequate. It's just a flavor. But I'm happy to talk about it at length, probably too much length. So you need to do these things in ways that integrate with existing goals. For example, Tao's blog. has been taught, actually the first year, 2007, has been turned into a book published by the American Mathematical Society. The second year is in the process of being turned into a book. So, you know, these are kind of very conventional sorts of ways of making a contribution, of building a case for tenure, not that he needs it, and so on and so forth. So sort of the way forward in some sense is to make gradual change in how we assess scientific work, how we assess scientists, and in the incentives that we use, basically meaning, you know, how do we actually decide whether somebody gets the grant, how do we decide whether or not somebody gets hired, these sorts of questions. People can make real contributions using some of these non-standard forms of media. Such changes have happened in a small scale, I think systematically across physics. Just a very small example, you know, the preprint archive, and in particular the citation services at Spires and Sitebase. When I go into faculty, hiring meetings over the last few years, everybody pulls their laptops out and they start browsing through the citation databases, which include preprints as well as conventional journal articles, and you go back and you track through to see who's been citing what. It's, I think, legitimized to some extent the preprint culture within physics, certainly more so than when I started as a physicist 13, 14 years ago. So that's the short, inadequate answer. I want to also talk a little bit about the long term, and I want to think back to the start of modern science and the person of Galileo. He built the first real astronomical telescopes, and one of the first things that he discovered was, of course, the rings of Saturn. And, you know, it's an astonishing discovery, and the natural question is, you know, did he share this discovery? And the answer is no. He did not share this discovery. In fact, that kind of sharing of scientific discovery was in some sense unimaginable to him. What he did instead was he wrote a letter to Kepler and several other people, and he sent Kepler an anagram. Here's the anagram. Okay. I should say, I have to tell you this, I just discovered this the other day. Kepler was, you know, of course, obsessive puzzler, and so he took the anagram and he worked at it and he worked at it and he worked at it. And eventually he decoded into something which, in Latin, if you translate it, roughly translates as Mars has two moons, which was a discovery he'd made shortly before. But he was really, really, really upset. And the reason why was because one of the letters wasn't used in his rearranging. So he wasn't sure whether he was right or not. And if, roughly speaking, if you translate it, it says, "I have discovered Saturn III formed." And actually, if you see what Galileo did originally, he didn't see, you know, a nice distinct ring structure. It's just kind of three blobs. Okay, so what this revealing it as an anagram did was it enabled Galileo to claim priority if anybody later on should say, "Oh, I've made this great discovery." But in the meantime, he didn't have to reveal the discovery and he could continue to build on it. It would be nice to say that Galileo was kind of unusual, but actually Huygens did the same thing, Leonardo did the same thing, Robert Hooke did the same thing. There were loads of reprehensible kind of practices like this. It was very common at the time. And part of the reason why was because there was no legitimized forum for sharing these kinds of discoveries. He couldn't conceive of a world in which it made sense to share the discovery. And part of the reason why was because the first journals actually didn't appear until more than 20 years after Galileo's death. So the first journals appeared in 1665. Oh, actually, it'll be on here. It's 1665. So it was, I think it was February of 1665. There's actually another journal which appeared a few weeks earlier. And we sort of think, well, okay, all of a sudden scientists started sharing discoveries. Actually, no, they didn't do that at all. Journals took decades to establish themselves as a legitimate means of sharing discoveries. So the first editor of the Philosophical Transactions, Henry Oldenburg, he used to do something, I mean, really quite reprehensible. So he was interesting in several ways. First of all, he was a polyglot. He knew all the languages, and he had correspondence absolutely everywhere. And what he used to do was he used to goad them. So he'd write to somebody and say, well, this scientist was saying that they've made loads of progress, and he'd scare them. And they'd write back to him and reveal a little bit more. And then he would write to the person he'd first mentioned. And apparently he actually deliberately inflamed, I've seen historians claim that he deliberately inflamed some of the scientific disputes simply to get people to reveal stuff in their letters to him, which he would then publish in the Philosophical Transactions. Another interesting fact was that he didn't submit stuff to this journal. Apparently, scientists—it was weird, kind of passive-aggressive behaviour. They'd write a letter to Oldenburg, hoping that Oldenburg would put it in the journal, but without actually explicitly requesting it. They were just writing to a friend. It's a kind of a strange sort of a behaviour to have engaged in, and it's all representative of this fact that journals weren't really legitimised at that point. And it took a lot of effort on the part of people like Oldenburg and many others to do so. So there's a real parallel to online media today where, they're not really quite, it's not quite legitimate to be blogging your thoughts or to be engaging in open notebook science or whatever, and it's going to take some considerable time. And, in the meantime, the thing which we do, I as a theorist, you kind of hoard clever observations and questions, basically against the day that it might one day mature into a full-fledged paper. Or you can, if you're an experimentalist, you may hoard data maybe code. And in general, I think scientists find it difficult to conceive of a world in which it makes sense to share all that information, even though we're now developing media which actually enable it to be shared. So over the short term, as I said, things will change very slowly. I think over the long term, major change is inevitable, particularly as the tools get much better. Michael Faraday, this is almost certainly a completely apocryphal story, but it's a nice one. Supposedly Queen Victoria approached him after a lecture and asked of what use is electricity, and he famously did not reply of what use is a newborn baby. And I've shown you these things, blogs, wikis, etc., open notebooks. They're not the end of online innovation. They're just the beginning. Actually, the tools which people use in 10 or 15 years will be much, much better than that. They'll enable us to scale up scientific conversation and scientific collaboration and really, in my opinion, change the architecture of expert attention. So that's what I think, this kind of budding blogosphere and wikis and whatnot are actually eventually leading to. And thank you all very much for your attention this afternoon.